Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about how many different types of magnetism are there? Well, it's a bit of a trick question, but at school you're taught that different materials are either magnetic or non-magnetic. As you go into it a bit more, you find out about electromagnets, and then you might hear about ferromagnetism and paramagnetism. But it is a bit of a trick question when you all come to see about it, because there's really only one type of magnetism. So the type of magnetism, or magnetic field, that is produced is symbol B or H, measured in Tesla, or a flux of Tesla per Tesla meter squared, the actual total flux is measured that way. But that is just only one type of thing, and it, however it's generated, it will bend an electron travelling through it, up or down, depending on its direction and its velocity and mass and all that type of stuff with the electron. It'll bend it up or down, or the proton up and down differently. It'll do the same sort of thing. You'll feel the same sort of force regardless of how it's generated. So the real question is, how many, can you name the different types of magnetic materials, and can you get the different types, not just an overbearing, overboring, sort of a huge list in your head, but can you sort it out? Sort of similar to you're admitting people into the grounds of a football match, a footy match, and there's kids, there's mamas, there's professionals, there's football players, there's, you know, rowdy. You can identify them and put them in a certain order. They've got a structure to it. So that's what we're going to go in this one, is just talk through the structure and talk through things. Now, this is going to be the first podcast where I'm going to launch an app with the podcast. It's a long time coming. So let's rewind a little bit and see where we're up to. So I've built I'm a robotics scientist, and I've built a LabVIEW engine where I just stick this in and it pulls up a screen. I type a few words about what the title is, instructions, a bit of a blurb, and then hit send. Now it's not perfect yet. It puts the click on URL at the bottom in expanded text, and there's a sort of a bit of labour. I've got to produce a HTML file and then email and include that in an email to the blogger and do all that sort of things. And so I've set it up so far that do the podcast, the LabVIEW handles it and posts it through the net and puts up the puts it into Blogger. Now, unfortunately, I still have to open up Blogger because I still haven't cracked how you can automatically attach labels to it. So I have to attach labels and enclosures. So that's opened up. That's a little bit of work, and I have to inspect it. And it's a little bit teeth-pulling because the way that you include pictures and stuff like that is a bit more complicated. And so down the track, by and by, that puts it to a feeder, and iTunes reads the feeder, and FeedBurner publishes it, publishes a synopsis to Twitter, and then Twitter has a hashtag linked to it to explain it doc, the hashtag explain it doc. So that's the limit there, and eventually I'll link it to Facebook and LinkedIn and get it going, and hopefully when it's got a large enough footprint, I'll be able to go through and get an expert in, someone who's got the know on how to actually extend it through social media. And now, as I'm producing this, I've produced 4 or 5 podcasts a day. That's got two features. One, it's let me be able to podcast in a more natural tone. All this training, I'm still not getting there. I still feel as though I'm at the 20% limit of being able to podcast clearly. But it's also meant that I've been able to build the software, run things out, and shake things out. So I just recently did a 4-part section on the laws of Newton. Now, I thought I was being clever by actually limiting the data load into the at the very start by making it, I think it's rather than 128 kilobytes, whatever, well, sampling, bit sampling at 8 bits. I'm not quite sure what it is, a mono. And then that automatically took it and put it down through the system. The system concatenates the various beginning music, end music, and stuff together. And that appeared good, but what happened is that although it plays reasonably well in a any softer media player or VLC, it doesn't. The browser playing engine's not smart enough to deal with stereo, hooked onto mono, hooked onto stereo again, and can't actually handle that. So I've thought, oh, what can I do? So ideally, I'll have to actually get up such that it's smart enough to interrogate the file and hook the appropriate grade of beginning music on, so it's contiguous across. So that's down the track. For the moment, I've stepped up and put everything at 128 samples, kilobit samples per second. It's a bit hard to comprehend what's going on there. The major thing which strikes me is that there's no compression going on at the moment. So my file is not at all compressed. There's no compression here. And that really hasn't struck podcasting, where it has struck an enormous amount of video compression going on here. So that's your overall strategy. Now, what's different? I know that you want to hear about magnetic fields, and we'll get onto it. But what's different is that, the deal is that I'm a research scientist looking at this type of stuff. I've written a engine which creates apps, and it creates apps for this exact type of thing. So I'll also include an inclusion here. I'll just have to think about how I can automate the inclusion of the app. But the app is of this form. It's not an app that most people will recognize, but it's an app using a form of mathematics which it gets you through a conversation. So there'll be a tile in the app which will have the conversation, and tiles you'll press to go down in detail. And I must admit, I've programmed it a while ago and forgotten about some of the details about how to actually put questions and answers. I'm a bit reticent about doing it because that will take me about half an hour to write and launch the app. Now, although that sounds incredibly quick, all it does is I write it in a app writing engine where I put in just basic text, build the app in the app writing engine, and it autonomously publishes it to the internet live without me doing anything about it. And I just put that link. And so it's a sort of a web app. So you'll see that linked to the back of this. And this is an ideal situation. And it can sort of explain the, sort of the, some of the problems I'm up against. In that, as I go through an expert level, I sort of begin to develop a view at three or four levels. I just did one on Brown Emotions, and I had to stop and redo it because I realized that I was doing that at four levels, the level of my initial understanding, the level of Brown's career, the level of the way that Brown Emotion was handled in society, and also the level of Brown as an important Australian botanist. That you've got all those four levels going together. This is, again, a multi-level thing, which is magnetic field. And you say, well, look, isn't it better that we just close the door on you, you multi-level idiot, and we will just continue the way we were teaching people very simple stuff and going through a very simple field? I think my honest, well, and that's the general problem up against. I'm going through this rehab, doing rehab myself, and getting no assistance. So I've really got no way to go but actually full on intellectual, sledgehammer through all of this. Yeah, so there's that thought of, look, Henry, isn't it better just to continue the way we were, just by saying, look, magnetism, it is, and there's no way that we can understand it, and they get a confusion between types of magnets and magnetism. Let's have it all confused, but it's nice and simple, and we ask questions consistent with our own understanding, and we mark them. And we train everyone consistent with our own understanding. And yeah, so there's that bottom line is that you can go into that field, but if you've been trained above it, there's no way that you can understand what mode of. There's not just a simplification of a field, it just doesn't simplify down to one culture. Each different cultural group will simplify it in a different way. And they're unaware that they've simplified it, so they can't actually tell it to you. So that's the overall idea. I'm trying to actually crack this nut with doing a podcast for every single lesson I go out, doing an app for every lesson that I produce, a website for every lesson that I produce, and then putting it out there and getting a coherent feedback on it. And it's not here yet. We'll get there very quickly. Okay, so as I said, what are the types of magnetic fields? Oh, well, there's only one type of magnetic fields, but there are several magnetic materials, or several magnetic materials, or ways of generating magnetic fields. And the sort of big dividing line is there's one, you can generate magnetic fields with an electric current. That's an electromagnetic. And that can be explained through special relativity. Indeed, yeah, if you've got a little speaker, that speaker is giving you sounds based on special relativity. It is each time you're listening to this, you are listening to special. If you're listening, you must be listening it to an electromagnetic speaker. I bet my listeners out there is listening on an iron speaker. But still, I still think that works on a magnetic property. But that bulk electricity moving past is a property of special relativity. So there's the first way. So electric fields are the same, but the ways you produce it, it's the either or. You can either produce it by a electric current in an electromagnet, or you can expose fundamental particles, because every fundamental particle in the universe is a small magnet. Take that home and chew on it. Electrons are small magnets, protons are small magnets, and indeed neutrons are small magnets. I don't think neutrinos are, and photons aren't, but of those, the bulk properties of what we consider an essential property of an object. Being the electrons, protons, and neutrons, we'd be happy with it. When we buy something in the supermarket, we say, look, I want that lump of cheese, and what you're really saying is, I want the electrons, protons, and neutrons arranged in such a way that it looks like cheese, tastes like cheese, is cheese. That's the basic things. And each one of those particles is a small magnet. How's that so? Well, we've got a few things to tell you. Each one of those particles has a spin. Each one of them is a fermion. It's got a spin up, spin down, and it is locked, either aligning or counter-aligning to the prevailing magnetic field. That's a hard thing to go. And how come I wasn't told about it? It's because I have to say, your teachers have been lying to you. Look, the universe after the Big Bang froze out, and the way it froze out is rotation got put into each and every little particle in terms of a unit of angular momentum, or I suppose a unit. I'm just trying to think. It's not. Is there angular momentum in a particle? There's angular momentum is the transaction, is the fundamental currency of the universe. So the fundamental currency of the universe is Planck's constant, h, and that's a fundamental unit of quantum of angular momentum or action. Angular momentum is in kilograms, meters squared, seconds to the neg one, or in joule Joule seconds. Yep, that's all right. I think that's all right. Just, yep, that's in my head. So it's sort of interesting that you can do things with Planck's constant to get energy, and you can also do it with things in Planck's constant to get momentum changes. So each time a little one of these guys changes energy or spins, flips its spin, or goes between energy states, it transfers a unit of angular momentum h. It's all very interesting to go along. But each one of these particles, part of them having spin, although they're not physically spinning, okay, they're not rotating at a speed. If they're spinning, you are entitled to ask, how fast are they spinning? Like, if you're saying, I'm spinning my wheels, how fast is it spinning? That the propeller on my aircraft is spinning, how fast is it spinning? The cars on my the wheels on my car are going, how fast are they going? You can't, we won't allow you to ask that, because spin doesn't exist in our universe as we perceive it. Like, we've got everything you touch, everything you experience tells you profoundly but indirectly that it's an S2 720 degrees inversion symmetry. I don't want to go too much into it, but associated with it is this spin, the magnetic force of the object. And we can describe that magnetic force of an object, how strong a magnet is. So if you've got a magnet, how strong is that magnet? Well, I can tell you it's got a dipole. It's got a north and a south, and the relative strength of that north and south is this much, and that's called the dipole strength or the magnetic strength. And so electrons have a magnetic strength, and if you have a beam with spin up, spin down, and you actually put it through a magnetic field, it will sort the electrons spin up, spin down. You can actually get all the spin up ones going through one bit and all the spin downs going through another bit. And it's really, really interesting. You say, well, look, if I can actually split my beams, it looks as though it comes from two sources. Well, here's something to get your mind around. You don't get a diffraction pattern. If you recombine them, if you get your electrons, split them with a magnetic field, and then look at a screen, you don't get a diffraction pattern at the end of it. How about that? So if I fire electrons between two slits, I'll get a diffraction pattern at the back. But if I fire them, if I do exactly the same thing, splitting it 50-50, so your screen will not show those diffraction pattern at the end. Yeah, and you say, well, you mean that the electron spin up does not superimpose with an electron spin down? So if you have just two electrons spin up, spin down, it'll going through a slit, through a double slit experiment. So you get a broad beam of electrons that's hit two slits, and they come through, and you've got two beams, split beams, and then they expand eventually, as we can imagine. Oh, I don't know. There's another way of doing it. If you actually hit the surface of nickel and you get a scatter off the surface, you'll get a diffraction pattern. But you won't get a diffraction pattern between spin up and spin down, because those electrons are really technically in different universes and they don't overlap with each other. And this is, say, oh, that's rubbish. Well, just look at helium or any element in the periodic table. You've got electrons sitting over themselves in space, and they can't see each other because they're of different spin. This is an important thing to go. So the fundamental thing is that a magnetic field, a magnet that we generally has a excess. We have engineered a permanent, so we can make an electromagnet to produce a generic magnetic field, or we can get a special material, which we call a magnet, and that has an excess of electrons. And electrons have a magnetic field, and we have those electrons all aligned, and that produces a magnet. So we've got two ways. We can plug it in, or we can gather a whole lot of those individual incy-wincy little particles and have them all aligned as tiny little baby norths, all working together to be a big north. And so if you can imagine that another path, the fundamental particle path, we can start to go that path is the type of material path. So it's the one path is the electronics classical physics, but I almost call special relativity classical physics, but it's not really, it's that still the last gasp of classical physics. The new physics is quantum physics. So it's the classical physics path, which is an electric circuit, or the fundamental particle path. And we're saying the electric field is the same, but the material and mechanism of making it is different. And we've got a range of materials. And now let's start to go through the range of materials. And I'll just start to list them one by one. There's diamagnetic, paramagnetic, super paramagnetic. But there's ferromagnetic, anti-ferromagnetic, and ferrite. Ferrimagnetic, F-E, that's ferro, F-E-R-R-O, and it's F-E-R-R-I. Magnetic, and ferromagnetic is actually anti-ferromagnetic with a bit of attitude, just to get your head around it. So, are these separate materials? No, they're materials. Each of these is sort of like a Venn diagram where diamagnetic encompasses all matter, and it's a property of all matter, and then if matter has got another property, that property can swamp the diamagnetic property. And then within paramagnetic things, you can have ferromagnetic. Then it breaks up into things. So inside your paramagnetic, you've got three little subsets, which I can think of. I won't put the ferro. Anti-ferro and the ferrites together. So these are different types of magnetic material. If you can understand, it's not that if it's paramagnetic, it's not that it's not diamagnetic. Paramagnetism has been unleashed, and it's allowed to dominate the diamagnetism. So all things are diamagnetic. And so what that means, let's go back. All things are diamagnetic, and that is, all matter is made up of all these mini magnets. So each electron is a mini magnet, each neutron and proton is a mini magnet. And the way that normal matter exists is those mini magnets are neatly stacked. If you've got a stack of magnets, right, in a drawer, they generally go together, not north pole facing north pole, but north pole facing south pole, and south pole facing north pole. They just arrange themselves to clump together, and so there's not a massive magnetic field coming out of it, because it's all trading itself very energy efficiently. All those magnetic field lines are bound within itself. So the magnetic field is actually coiled up within inside the atom, and so it looks magnetically inert, even though there's a whole heap of these mini magnets ready to be pulled apart. And what happens when you apply a magnetic field, these magnets change energy to be repelled by the magnetic field. Now, there's quantum mechanically, it's easy to see. There's a sort of classical thing of saying that, or Lenz's law, that you can do all these classical analogies that as you apply a magnetic field to something, it generates a compensating magnetic field against it. So if you put introduce a north field, it will induce a north field against it. It won't produce a south field for it, it will produce a north field across it. And indeed, everything in the universe is slightly repelled by magnetic fields. That's hard to get your mind around. but please go onto YouTube and do magnetic levitation of a frog. Indeed, the US, for some reason, they're making these enormously powerful electromagnets made out of these enormous conductors. It's quite interesting to see them put it together. These make huge magnetic fields, and the magnetic field is such that it repels, and that just, what we do, I chuck in a frog. So it's large enough for a small living animal, a frog to be put in, and there's these people who go around with these new huge neodymium super magnets, and push grapes and mice. They put mice in a little beaker, and you can actually push it around. You can actually do this in school, I think. You can get an ice cube and push it around with a fairly reasonable magnet. You can actually just, a reasonable magnet will repel most things, or everything in the universe. Every piece of condensed matter, that is, which is in the plasma, it's not ionized, it's just sitting there. All the electrons and protons have all settled down, and hey, I'm a solid. Any solid. Yeah, and I suppose you'd say liquid. Liquids. And gas. Look at gas, you can do it as well. Yeah, there are examples. It's really interesting, the state of oxygen which breaks it. So you can actually pour liquid oxygen down between two magnets, and it doesn't pour, but it gets stuck by the magnetic field. But everything else gets repelled by magnetic fields. And what happens is that you can imagine as the electric field pushes in, it starts to backpedal and creates. So if you add a noise, the natural response of any material, when you put a north pole to it, it generates an offending north pole and pushes away. And that's diamagnetic. Most things are diamagnetic. Bismuth is just the darling. It's apparently, bismuth has got a huge diamagnetic moment. And so it's your choice of an element which really sticks up there with diamagnetic. And of course, bismuth is up there in the periodic table. It's the one after lead, and lead is under carbon. I'm just trying to I'll just have to go get my head around this. But that's in the P block. So bismuth is in the P block. Beautiful, beautiful material. But it is diamagnetic. It is repelled by magnetic field. So if you get a little bead of business, you should be able to push that bismuth away quite well. Look, an example I've got my little block of carbon. I've got to really remember where it is, because I really like my little block of carbon, and I have magnets, and I put my magnet on top of the block, and you can feel it's not strong enough to levitate. I have to talk to you about this. I may as well talk to you about it. It's not strong, but you can definitely feel that it's not pushing. It hasn't got the same. It doesn't feel scrapey. It's just pushing across. However, you can get your pencil lead. Again, YouTube it out. You can get your pencil lead and get an arrangement. This is your, you know, those thin little pencil leads you have in the retractable pencils that feed through. And you can get one of those, and you can float it above a series of magnetic fields. I've got nice little views of that. And of course, the sort of king of diamagnetism, sort of light diamagnetism, bismuth is, you know, diamagnetic, but it's heavy. But in terms of weight for diamagnetism, is carbon. And the material, of course, which is the best, is this isotropic carbon, the carbon which is coated inside my new cyborg heart valve. So my heart valve is coated with a diamagnetic material, and my heart valve, if I put it on top of a powerful magnet, would float there. And in fact, you can go on the internet and say pyrolytic isotropic carbon. It's one of those things. It's isotropic pyrolytic carbon. It's basically a chaotic bundle of little carbon flakes, graphite flakes together. It's a real super material. It's a super material that they've implanted in my heart. I have a beautiful piece of carbon quantum mechanical material which will not crack or ever shatter, and has at least a lifetime of 10 million yes, or calculated or experimentally in a lab proven. They've cycled it through for 10 million years. Reproducibility, I'm sure there's some other flaws they haven't thought about which will creep in at 9 million years. And, you know, one day before warranty, I'm sure my mind will crack out. But my heart valve and things, so a lot of things will float on magnetic fields because they're diamagnetic. So diamagnetic, energy, or quantum mechanically, you say the energy levels split and you have spin orbits and things pushing away. Classically, you have electrons being raised to a higher energy level, which counter-rotate against the magnetic field, and the magnetic field comes out. That's complete madness. They have electrons in a track, and you say, well, the energy level is split, and so this goes at a higher energy level, so it rotates a higher field and produces a higher net magnetic field. I don't know how you go through that. I'll look at that. So that's diamagnetic. So diamagnetic is everything. However, if you have a unbalanced an electron pointing away, that's paramagnetic. So if you look at your periodic table, and I may put a link to this, a periodic table, I think, has one magnetic property one. It's a pretty disappointing 3D periodic table. I'll see if I can get a link to it. It shows you, that's right. So I just visualized it here in my head. So I just can remember, fluorine has got no property. And what the heck is that? Fluorine's got no property whatsoever. Everything else has a property of being paramagnetic or diamagnetic. All the things in the P block and beryllium, which, again, if you know the quantities of the table, and I think oxygen is paramagnetic, and all the metals are paramagnetic. That is, they have... Oh, no, they're not all paramagnetic. There's some which are I just have to really scrape my head for it. Beryllium is diamagnetic. All the metals are paramagnetic, as far as I can see, with, you know, one or two exceptions, which we'll get to. Now, the being paramagnetic is that when it's under the influence of a magnetic field, it will show a I have to really think about aluminium, but have a free fundamental particle, mostly an electron, in fact always an electron, and this will rotate such that, or spin will flip or align such that its south is pointing to your north. So when you have something, I think copper, I'm trying to remember, I think copper may be one exception, which is a metal which is diamagnetic, but say silver, for instance, silver's you're pretty confident about. Silver will point its tiny little electrons to it, and you'll be able to get those tiny little electrons pointing their pole of the electron, the magnetic pole of the electrons will be pointing towards it, and so you'll get a slight attraction. There'll be an ever so slight attraction between it. And this is slight, and it's so small that we say it's non-magnetic, but it's paramagnetic. And what will happen is, you can think through, there's going to be a slight, it's a very weak effect, it's weakly attracted. So things like titanium, I'm pretty sure, titanium is a paramagnetic, I see in my head. That material, if you have a strong magnet, it will very, very slightly attract to the field. And the reason is it's got a few electrons which are free to rotate, give their magnetic field. So if you look, sort of a way of explaining it is that there used to be train sets, those train sets, and they used to have it such that no matter what happened, the magnetic field would attract. It had a little north-south magnet on a flippy thing, and so it would just, no matter how you put it together, it would never repel, it would always attract. That'd flip over to stick to each other, and that's what's happening in the paramagnetic. So everything's diamagnetic, And then within that, if it's got anything loose, there's a few exceptions. If there's anything loose, it will be paramagnetic. That is, it will be slightly... So there's a weak repulsion. Everything's got a weak repulsion force. If it's got something loose, it will have a strong attraction force. And then we start to go down the lines of those things which flip, if they flip socially, if they align themselves to a magnetic field, and they do it such that they are sensitive to the local magnetic field, they can form domains. And so there's cobalt, nickel, and iron are the three amigos of the ferromagnetics ones. I have to really think about what's happening in the what happens in the rare earths. I think the rare earths are a bit more of a complex story. There's gandalum. One of those rare earths is also ferromagnetic. I'm just purely going off imagery in my head. I'll have to get this straight. And they're ferromagnetic, and that means that each individual atom, little mini magnet associated with each individual atom, will will influence its neighbours. And so what will happen is that it will locally trap inside it its local magnetic field. And what you can do, and so it's all everything inside it, rather than being randomly, will either align or counter-align to its local internal magnetic field, and you'll create something called magnetic domains, ferromagnets, F-E-R-R-O magnets. And these will have domains as areas in which every atom does the same thing. It's sort of like bin week. You drive past and you see a few bins out, I'll put my bin out, and then you put your bin out. It means that your neighbour looks at it and puts all, and it's pretty soon you'll have everyone putting the same bins out. Now, obviously that's been done by people looking at calendars, but say that we didn't know the days of the week, we would, the bin trucks would go to where bins were put out. But you'd just have groups, areas of suburbs where everyone would put their bins out. A few people would ignore it, and then they'd put it out on another day. You know, they've already put it out on Monday, we'll put it out on Tuesday. So this is about the domains. A domain will be north-facing or south-facing domains. They point up and down. I think I'm just trying to work out whether you can randomize directions of domains. So they'll point there. And this is a ferromagnetic thing. So what happens is that you can grow... you can actually, so it's a strong magnet, and it's all randomized, and if you put it in a magnetic field, it will actually grow and increase in size. So this is what you call a magnetic material that you have in school is really a ferromagnetic material, and it's non-permanent. That is because the domains only grow and shrink, grow in size, under the influence of magnetic fields. So what happens is that something is magnetic if it turns into a magnet. The definition of a magnetic material is a material that turns into a magnet in a magnetic field. There you go. So you introduce a magnet, and what will happen is you put your magnet over a piece of iron, and where the magnetic field, the north part of the magnetic field, will induce a south pole in your magnet, in your piece of iron. So ferromagnetic is materials which turn into a full-blown, large-scale ordered magnet. There's two sorts of things. Ferromagnetism is always there, but if you can actually add something to it, such that the large fields grow, and then they can't shrink anymore. The lowest magnetic field is like everything pointing north and nothing south. You know, they're all fields aligned. Is a high energy state. So you would know that if you have two magnets and you try and sit them together and have the two norths pointing up and two souths pointing down, it will tend to flip. And so this aligned magnet is a high energy state. And so you have to have something which pins it together, some sort of glue which sticks the domains pointing in the same direction. And obviously, as you heat it up to the Curie's temperature, all these domains flip and reorder. So if you've got a high magnet, a strong magnet, and you heat it up, or you heat any magnet, it will accept, there's an exception to it. It will not be magnetic anymore. And this Curie temperature was known way back. I thought it was discovered by Curie, named after Curie there, but it was known in Newton's time. It's known that if you have a magnet and you heat it up, it's no longer magnetic. Also, if you've got a permanent magnet in an electric field, you're poling a magnet in the electric field, it's best to actually heat it up, and then you don't need a strongest magnetic field. You heat it up in a magnetic field, it aligns, and then you cool it down. You're left with a strong magnet. What it means is that these magnets that you have, besides these magnets I used to have, calibrate machines and stuff like that, they decay with time. Because they're in a high energy state, they exponentially decay with time. And so, particularly in older materials made out of poorer quality engineered magnets, you'd measure and you'd almost plot, not by the, it wouldn't decay by the day, but also if you're making optoelectronic materials which have magnets in them, you have to look up their decay time. So it's one of these things people don't think. So these are ferromagnets. So ferromagnets have domains, and so ferromagnets are a subset of paramagnetism, and they have domains, and it means that they have a lower energy state, which where every nearest neighbor is pointing in the same direction. But as this means that it wants its lowest energy is little islands of north, a few hundred thousand, a million atoms pointing north, and then you move it to the next neighborhood, a few atoms, everything's pointing south. So the magnetic field lines, if you like, are swirling within it, if you were able to pull yourself through it. So that's diamagnetics, everything, a subset of diamagnetic materials, materials with the odd angry electron, and then a subset of that where the electrons can influence, the magnetic field is influence each other, sort of neighbor to neighbor influence. You've got ferromagnetics, but a separate thing is that you can have anti-ferromagnetic materials, things that if my next neighbor is north, my lowest state, my friend, is south, and then the next one after it will be north, and so it goes north, south, north, south, north, south. This is means that you get no domains, and you get something called spin glass. And there's amazingly only a few anti-ferromagnetic. It's sort of hard to get your mind around why would something be anti-ferromagnetic. And I think the research papers has only happened in the end of last. It was a bit of a mystery how these things were anti-ferromagnetic. But the one element in the periodic table, it's got the crown of being anti-ferromagnetic material, is chromium. So chromium is anti-ferromagnetic, and the reason it is to spin oscillations on the Fermi surface, and something to do with the crystal structure. You really get into the crystal structure of it. So you would think that anything iron would be magnetic, but stainless steel, which has a certain amount of nickel in it, has everything in it which is magnetic, just has a few, obviously it's got the chromium to form the layer on top, but the one thing it doesn't do, it's no longer ferromagnetic, so stainless steel isn't ferromagnetic, but this is anti-ferromagnetic. This is where it forms spin glass. So it's all chaotic. All the spins are chaotic. The magnetic fields are really chaotic inside it. And this is important. Let's stop here before we get onto the last level, and we'll go back and re-talk it. You can create something called a spin valve. Are you okay there? You can create something called a spin valve, and that is where you sandwich a ferromagnetic, a spacer, and an anti-ferromagnetic material. Okay, we're talking about a spin valve. And now, what does this mean? This means something which is, we've got anti-ferromagnetic, a gap of non-magnetic material, and then ferromagnetic material. And this means that the orientation of your small amount of anti-ferromagnetic materials up in the air, how do I describe it? But look, the basic thing is that spin valve is something which can be miniaturized and can detect by resistance. It's changing resistivity with the magnetic field, and essentially your computer hard drive, if you've got one of those mechanical ones still, you've got a mechanical hard drive, the terabit ones, it drags a little spin valve over the surface of a piece of magnetized material to measure the magnetic field. So a spin valve seems to be a really important thing. Again, look it up. I think it's the only use I know of anti-ferromagnetic material. And there's chromium, there's a few other composite materials. And it's something to do with the a spin wave on the Fermi surface, which I can imagine, and the Fermi surface is shaped by the crystal structure. So it means that the actual area, the particle-to-particle lowest energy state is not spin-aligned, but spin-counter-aligned. And so you can get these fantastic functions going across, so you can actually balance the ferromagnetic with anti-ferromagnetic and actually get it to trigger to be predominantly ferromagnetic or nothing. You can actually cancel it in a composite material. So there's a final thing is called the ferrite. So ferrites have are similar to anti-ferromagnetic, the ferrimagnetic, F-E-R-R-I magnetic materials, and they have a similar state, but you can actually encourage it becomes magnetic or it changes how its property in the presence of magnetic field. So its bulk material is it chops and changes between spin up and spin down, or north and south, particle to particle. But you can increase the north particle over the south particle with the magnetic field. And of course, ferrites are the very material that you have in transformers, because it can conduct or channel magnetic field lines without forming domains. And so that's sort of the critical thing why they're used in high frequency transformers. I haven't really explain this very well, but let's go over it. Let's go over it again, the various limits. You've got electromagnets, these are bulk things, or you've got fundamental particles, or fundamental matter. That's its response to magnetic fields. The response to magnetic fields can eventually produce a magnetic field line which go away from the material. This is your ferromagnets can produce a permanent magnet. Now, in that area, fundamental particles, you've got diamagnetics, and within which is all things that repel, weakly repel, or you can get them to be paramagnetic, which is they weakly repel, but they have a an out of control electron in it, which then responds to the field and attracts to the field, so that dominates the repulsion. Then they can have a social interactions between neighboring particles, and if the social is, they all go in the same direction, so you can make ferromagnetics. If they go in opposite directions locally, they want to go rather north to north, it likes to go north south north south north south, it's anti-ferromagnetic, which we can use, or you can get ferrites, which is the same thing, but you can influence the strength of the north ones to be more responsive in a field, and so you get the channeling of the field lines, the response without the growth of domains and hysteresis. And of course, in there you've got other things which I haven't talked about, which is supermagnets and super paramagnetism. So essentially, if you can dice up ferromagnets and stop the domain growth enough, you can make it look as though it's a just as a non-ferromagnetic. You can destroy the ferromagnetic properties of a ferromagnet. And there you go. So what I'll do is I'll launch a app with this one to see how it goes. Thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.